Well, playing games has been important to many cultures, perhaps most cultures, through human history. And next we're going to take a look at seven different games, how they were developed, and why we play them. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Our guest is Oliver Rader. Ollie's been a senior writer at 538, also editor of The Riddler, a collection of the site's math puzzles. He studied artificial intelligence at Harvard University, holds a PhD in economics focused on game theory, and his latest book is Seven Games, A Human History. And lots of calls and comments that are in our show that we just, the segment we just concluded on three great card games. But there are games in this book that I know many of you played as well. And I know you're going to have some fun learning the backstory on some of them. And I hope you'll join in. Why do you play games? Do you think it's help you as an adult? Join in. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Oliver Rader, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Where did your love of games come from?
I've loved them as long as I can remember. Games were a love language in my family. And I heard a bit of the earlier segment and euchre. Euchre has been the staple ever since I could hold cards in my hands. My family played euchre. So,
those games helped in shaping your life, did they not?
Absolutely. I think the border between games and the real world is a porous one. I think we take lessons from games playing back with us into the real world and vice versa. I think we take lessons from the real world to the games table. And one sort of idea I try to unpack in my book is that games are sort of small, crystallized models of some aspect of the real world, sort of tiny slices of life that we can sort of take a minute away from our daily lives and sort of focus on and study and perfect and of course enjoy.
Do you play, by the way, do you play Wordle or Sudoku?
I do Wordle. I can't help but Wordle. And a big crossword puzzle solver and a spelling bee on the New York Times. So I really have my word work cut out for me each morning.
Well, you talk about the games as the idea of games as practice.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I'll describe it this way. So in my book, Seven Games has seven chapters, each devoted to a particular game. And the chapters are arranged purposefully, whereby as you move through the book, you're sort of adding a feature. So, for example, as you move from, say, checkers to chess, you're adding complexity. Or as you move from chess to backgammon, you're adding randomness via the roll of the dice. And finally, from something like backgammon to poker, you're adding hidden information, the idea of deception and bluffing and not knowing what your opponent holds. And I sort of make the argument that, well, these added features as we move through the book are also things that are really important in the real world, right? The real world has a lot of randomness. The real world has a lot of hidden information. And as we play these games, we get exposed to these features, which we then encounter in our everyday lives. And by playing these games, we can sort of grapple with the complexity of the real world in a very specific way.
Yeah, that's well put. And you've been playing all of these games for a long time.
Yeah, that's right. And as I wrote, as I reported and researched and wrote each chapter, I tried to play as much of that specific game as I could, just to sort of immerse myself in the flavor of the game. Just as if, you know, if you're writing a book about, I don't know, Van Gogh paintings, you would probably pin a bunch of Van Gogh paintings in your room. I tried to do exactly the same with games, sort of immerse myself. And because I think listeners will be sympathetic to this idea that each game has a sort of feeling to it that you can only sort of get by actually sitting down and playing.
And you mentioned five of the games. You got up to poker, but you also have Scrabble, which I love, and Bridge, which I never have played, but I have a lot of friends who played.
Scrabble is probably the game I've played the most, and maybe the game I'm personally best at. I spent a large chunk of my grad school years playing in Scrabble tournaments, probably to the chagrin of my thesis committee and others in my professional life. Huge Scrabble fan, and again, as excuse me, as part of the reporting for the book, played in the North American Scrabble Championship, which that year was held in Reno, Nevada. So split my time between the Scrabble tournament and the poker table across the street.
Well, the first game in the book is checkers. And, you know, when I saw that, I played a lot of checkers. Most of us have, I think here in Wisconsin, probably everywhere else, have played checkers a lot. And I never thought of it. You can dismiss it as a kid's game at my level. And I did until I read your chapter. I was amazed. Talk about the history of the game first.
Yeah. So checkers belongs to this sort of class, like a few of the games in the book, of truly ancient games with a millennia long history. And, these games, backgammon is another, Go is another, chess to some extent. These games are found wherever we find, we meaning archaeologists, anthropologists, wherever we find the remnants of human civilization, we find games. And we find games like checkers or like backgammon. So like a truly, deeply ancient history. And I agree. I had this sort of preconceived notion when I started writing the checkers chapter that, yeah, checkers was a child's game, sort of pre-chess, this game sort of limited to the elementary school cafeteria, you know, when it's raining during recess or whatever. But in fact, it turns out to be this sort of hauntingly deep game. And whatever it lacks in complexity compared to, say, chess, its top players make up for with depth, the idea that they can see so far ahead into the future, sort of orders of magnitude more than, say, a chess player might. And the checkers chapter focuses around these two really colorful, really fascinating, important characters. One is the best checkers player the world has ever seen.
Tinsley?
Indeed, I would argue the best competitor at any competitive pursuit that the world has ever seen, a man named Marion Tinsley. And his opponent, in a sense, a computer scientist named Jonathan Schaefer, who devoted his life to crafting a computer program that could beat Marion Tinsley, that could beat the best checkers player that humanity has ever known. And the chapter sort of revolves around their sort of clash.
That is, it was an amazing, at one point you mentioned the number of potential moves. It was just flummoxed when I read that. You use an example about the cups of water in the Pacific Ocean, for example. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, if I remember correctly, the number of possible checkers positions is 500 billion billion, which exactly as you say, if you took a small cup and filled up the Pacific Ocean from that cup, that's how many cupfuls you would need. So incomprehensibly large.
And what was it about Marion Tinsley? He couldn't have known all those moves in his head.
Certainly not all of them. But I think, you know, like most people get good at most games through sort of this pure driven devotion. And Marion Tinsley had two loves in his life. One was the game of checkers and one was his Christian faith. He was an evangelical minister and a preacher. And he sort of devoted his time sort of equally and similarly to these two pursuits. And new checkers ideas came to him out of the clear blue sky, he said, exactly like he also said his insights into scripture. So he's a man with two very sort of fervent faiths, one of which happened to be checkers.
And he would talk about his faith to the players, too.
Yeah, that's right. He apparently sort of proselytized on the Checkers tournament scene. And a very, very, very interesting man. And it's really hard to do justice to just how good he was at Checkers. But I'll try briefly. In a 40-year span of tournament play, in which he played over 1,000 games of Checkers, he lost 3 times. Just unbelievable levels of performance.
3 times out of 1,000.
That's right.
He was beaten, and Jonathan Schaefer was after him because and had a computer program that he designed. And what? Oh, here we are coming up the top of the hour. I hear Tyler in the music, so I got to remind you, our guest today. This is a fascinating book. It's called Seven Games, A Human History. Oliver Roeder is the author. By the way, his last name is spelled R-O-E-D-E-R. Oliver Roeder. And the book Seven Games, and he'll be with us up until 12:30 today, and to talk about not only checkers, but we'll get into chess and pokers and backgammon. He's got some fascinating stories, and you can join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. We'll be back right after this look at the news. You stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about games and why we play them with our guest, Oliver Roeder. Ollie's a senior writer at 538, editor of The Riddler, a collection of the site's math puzzles. He studied artificial intelligence at Harvard University, holds a PhD in economics focused on game theory. And his latest book is Seven Games, A Human History. Fascinating book. Why do you play games? Do you have questions about some of the games that we'll be talking about? And again, the seven are checkers, chess, backgammon, go, poker, Scrabble, and bridge. I think I got them all. I think I got them all there. You may, I'm betting you played at least one of those games. So questions about the games themselves, or maybe why you play them, or why you like to play them. Join in 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. So you're a computer guy for sure. And checkers are the first game, or one of the first games at least, that where computers kind of got involved, and probably because of Jonathan Schaefer?
Yeah, Schaefer was a big part of it, but the history of computers playing games goes back to as long as there have been computers.
No.
And why do computer scientists want to get computers to play games? Well, games appeal to computers for the same reason they appeal to humans, their practice. Right. And if we want to build artificial intelligence, a machine that's intelligent, setting them loose on games is a pretty good start because games have these features that we see in the real world. So games are a very important test bed for artificial intelligence and indeed have been central to the development of modern artificial intelligence. And yes, Schaefer's story battling the great Marion Tinsley over the checkers board was a real, real seminal moment in this history.
He ran a computer. Describe the computer program he ran. You kind of end that chapter with the sort of the conclusion of the computer of the program. But
yeah, Schaefer's computer program was named Chinook, which is named after a wind that blows through Canada, where Schaefer lives. Why a wind? Well, in some parts of the world, checkers is called draft wind. Anyway, Chinook, like many computer games playing computer programs of the day, sort of does two things. It searches through the game, possible futures in the game, as quickly as it can. And every time it arrives at a possible future, performs some calculation. Is this a good checkers position? Is this a bad checkers position? So it searches what's often called the tree of a game, sort of branching futures, and tries to find what's the best branch, what's the best path to go down. And as computers get faster, they get better because they can search more of the game's sort of tree. And that's sort of in contrast to what someone like Marion Tinsley or you or I would do, which is sort of more to rely on intuition. We sort of feel that this move is good. We're not performing these sort of rote calculations. So it's really a clash of styles, and a clash of styles that we saw repeated in many games for many decades.
Yeah, and certainly that it was very interesting in your chapter on chess as well, which I have unfortunately never learned to play chess. And I was so glad when in my daughter's grade school they were teaching the kids how to play chess, because I never learned it. And to be honest, I really got interested in it again when I watched the Netflix series, The Queen's Gambit, which was fascinating to me anyway. It was fascinating on many levels, but just this whole business about chess. People who can really play it well, even though they may have some other foibles that mitigate against them. Where did it originate, chess?
The most common and probably the best theory is that it originated in India around 1500 years ago. And it originated for sort of the reasons you would expect, that it was sort of a miniaturized military exercise. And indeed, the pieces that we find from 1500 years ago from India sort of comported with the pieces of the Indian military of that day. So, for example, there was an elephant, which has become the modern day bishop, and so on. So it sort of chess sort of was what it said on the tin. It was a miniature battle used for practice. I think Queen's Gambit is actually enormously important in the recent history of chess. It caused a huge sort of boom and rebirth in the game, especially among younger players, especially among women players. And chess has sort of become an esport, a game that people play on the internet, stream on sites like Twitch. So this 1500-year-old game stays very vibrant and robust thanks to the internet. It's sort of this fascinating history of this ancient game.
It's a fascinating story. I was kind of taken by your little account of the Mechanical Turk and Edgar Allan Poe.
Fascinating sort of chapter of history. So in the 17th century, something called automatons were all the rage, these sort of robot-like mechanical creations that did various things, from sort of playing musical instruments to replicating the movements of an animal, and to playing chess, or at least supposedly playing chess. So this famous example is called the Turk, or the Mechanical Turk, based on its sort of fashionable Ottoman garb that it was dressed in. And it was sort of purely mechanical machine, made of, you know, a wood figure that looked like a chess player, and a box full of gears and sort of clockwork, and took on all comers, and debuted in the, you know, court of the Austro-Hungarian Empire to great sort of acclaim. And people of that day thought that this was legitimate, that this was a machine, not a man or a woman. This was a machine playing chess and beating strong human players. Of course, it wasn't. It was an elaborate ruse, and there was a good chess player hidden in the box among the clockwork, actually making the moves. But I think this was still a watershed moment. And chess has done two things. Chess has sort of been sort of tied up with our very idea of intelligence itself. This idea that, oh, like if he's good at chess, he must be a pretty smart guy. And we use it metaphorically, like this smart person is playing chess while everybody else is playing checkers, this sort of idea. And it sort of got tangled up with the idea of intelligence, and therefore became a prime target of developers of artificial intelligence. So essentially, ever since the 17th century, this has been a dream of computer scientists or engineers of all stripes. Can we make a machine better than the best human at chess?
And you do to write about that as well, Kasparov. Kasparov? How's his
yeah,
name?
Yeah, that's right.
Played against Big Blue? I'm trying to remember.
Deep Blue.
Deep Blue, that's right. Deep Blue, sorry.
Yeah, so this was sort of the culmination of that centuries-long history in the late 1990s. So IBM developed a supercomputer, this one not a hoax, a real supercomputer, with the explicit goal of beating Garry Kasparov, who was the world chess champion at the time, arguably the best chess player who's ever lived. And there was this, you know, hugely important match, man versus machine, which ended in New York City in 1997, when Deep Blue beat Kasparov in a best of five game match. And this caused a sort of, you know, a bit of an existential crisis, I think, in Kasparov, but also in many other human observers. Like, what does this mean for our species? What does this mean for the game of chess? And these sort of contests have continued in other games, and we sort of go through this existential crisis each time. But we're still here. We still play these games. These games are still fun. So I think these contests have certainly been credit is deserved by the computer scientists who built these machines, but existential crisis, I think, unnecessary.
You know, there's a guy here from Wisconsin originally. His name is Phil Hellmuth Jr. And so when I got to your chapter on poker, I thought immediately of him. I happened to be on the UW Athletic Board, and his father was on the board as well. And Phil was a student here at the UW, and he played in the World Series of Poker and won for the first time. And it was quite a to-do. That was in the 90s, I think. I had a chance to meet him and talk to him, but I remember when he won the first time, he chartered a plane and brought his parents and all of his friends out to for a vacation in Las Vegas. But I think he's won 16 World Series of Poker games. But poker, talk about poker. It's different from the first couple, you know, games we talk about, because there is some randomness introduced, and how does that change the approach to the game?
Right. Well, I didn't know Hellmuth was a Wisconsin man.
Yeah.
So I also played in the World Series of Poker, and
yes,
I have won zero times. So I played in an event specifically for the book, so I could get a sense of what is it like in Vegas during the World Series. I think that poker was sort of a final frontier for computers because of exactly what you mentioned: randomness via the shuffled deck of cards. And hidden information. So I don't know what cards you have and vice versa. And it's not hard to see that this hues the game fairly closely to a lot of aspects of the real world. I mean, a lot of things have randomness and hidden information. We might say warfare, for example, courtship, negotiations, sort of in lots of really meaty, heady stuff that we do in the real world shares some important features with poker. And why was it a final frontier for computers? Why is it so difficult? Well, having randomness makes the game a lot more complicated, because whereas every game of chess begins exactly the same way, right? With the pieces set up this way, every hand of poker begins differently because we've shuffled the deck and we've dealt it out in some random unknown way. So just mathematically speaking, the game is what a mathematician would say bigger. There's more possibilities.
There's more limbs in the trees and branches.
That's exactly right. The tree is more thickly, densely branched than a game like chess, which is already incredibly complicated. So But, you know, computers will never stop getting faster. Programs and algorithms will never stop getting more efficient. And indeed, while I was at the World Series of Poker a couple of years ago, it was announced that computers had essentially conquered this game too, the same game I was attempting to play in Las Vegas. And one of these, and you know, what I'm sort of trying to draw these parallels between games and the real world is not just an academic argument I'm making. One of the strongest computer poker playing computer programs was licensed to the Pentagon to do sort of war gaming type research. And so this border, as I mentioned before, this border between games and the real world is a porous one, and things pass through from one to the other. But yes, unfortunately, I did not come home with a World Series of Poker bracelet, but I hope readers agree that I came home with some good stories.
You tell such wonderful stories in the book. You're such a good writer, your stories in all the chapters are really, really interesting. And you tell about running into Doyle Brunson. crashing into him.
we nearly collided in the poker room of the Bellagio, and I was like, okay, this is going in the chapter. later I sort of use an example of a hand that Doyle Brunson played. So Doyle Brunson is this old school Texas road hustler, very famous poker player. And I sort of give this example of a hand he played against Daniel Negreanu, a.k.a. Kid Poker, sort of representative of the sort of new school computer-driven, if you like, approach. And I sort of walk through a hand of how does the old school player pre-computer think about a hand of poker, and how does the new school, younger, computer age human player think about a hand, and what does it look like when those two clash with hundreds of thousands of dollars on the table?
Yeah, it was a fascinating story within the story of poker. I do, because we still have some time left here, but I wanted to get to Scrabble. By the way, just one more thing on the AI part of it, because actually a lot of even professional players are using programs. You talk about one guy who's made a fair amount of money just working with some of the professionals on their game through the computer simulations.
Yeah, that's right. And professional poker players, you know, can't use these things at the table while you're playing, of course, but you can use them to train and to analyze what you did do, trying to plug any leaks in your play, improve your play for the next time you go to the casino. I was told by computer programmers that every the top 10 poker pros in the world have computer programmers on the payroll to sort of tweak their games to eliminate every little leak, every little mistake tendency that they might have. And so there's a real sort of wedding of the silicon with the human professional these days.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Scrabble, which I love to play, is another one of the books, games that you talk about. And you are a very good Scrabble player.
Well, I used to be. I was a little rusty, as I discovered trying to re-enter the national championships. But yeah, Scrabble is an interesting game. I mean, the key to becoming good at Scrabble is, you know, it's sort of a dubious honor, because the key to becoming good is just to spend an inordinate amount of time studying words. And that's what I did. You know, to become good at Scrabble is essentially to memorize the dictionary, the list of valid Scrabble words. And why did I do this? I'm not entirely sure. It was very rewarding to sort of get good, to find these obscure words, to play them. And it's a sort of, you know, it's a sort of meditative thing, sort of learning word after word after word. And I think unlocking vast swaths of the dictionary that you would have no other cause to use, right? Scrabble is the only sort of domain in my life where I use obscure foreign currencies or medieval weapons or, you know, all these things that sort of bubbled up into my brain thanks solely to the game of Scrabble.
Yeah. But there's a downside to it that you point out as well. And that is, when you get really good at it, then it becomes an issue or problematic when you have to play with the relatives or
I can't play Scrabble at home anymore. I can't play a lot of Scrabble unless it's with a tournament player, because, you know, I think you see this in other games too, like say chess. I mean, it's very difficult for a novice to take on an expert, and I think in Scrabble that's doubly true, because I think most people like to think of themselves as having a pretty good grasp of the English language. I think most people are sort of proud of their vocabularies and think they're well-spoken and so on. But then, you know, you play an obscure word that's second nature to a Scrabble player, but no one in the real world would have any cause to use this word. And there's this sort of disconnect, you know, that's not a word, you're cheating, this sort of thing. So yeah, it's sort of, in a sense, getting good at Scrabble ruins Scrabble for you a little bit.
You've got a, when you would play with family, you'd almost have to have that Scrabble dictionary right next to your.
That's right. You know, I think, but you know, I think even if I gave you the Scrabble dictionary, Larry, I'm not sure we'd have such a competitive match. I'm sorry to say.
You would not. There would be no match. I wouldn't want to play with you because it would be very, very frustrating. Indeed. And I like to play, and it's a lot of fun to play. Well, what are your thoughts on these games, the role of games in our lives and our world life?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably needless to say, I think the role is an incredibly important and incredibly central one, I think, for a few reasons, some obvious and some more subtle. I mean, the obvious one is they're fun, right? They're enjoyable ways to pass time. Why were games so popular in the ancient world? Well, you know, as the great philologist Irving Finkel once said, there was bugger all to do in the ancient world. Like, what are you going to do? You're not going to watch TV, so you're going to play games. And, you know, I think we've all collectively experienced a recent time where there was bugger all to do, right? The pandemic. Yeah. And indeed, in the early days of the pandemic, I think continuing to today, there's been more games played than at any time in human history. And you can show this empirically with how many games are played on chess.com and so on. So games are fun, and there's this sort of solace. I also think, like I was mentioning throughout, games are this sort of practice, sort of ways to sort of hone our skills for when we go back to our real lives. And finally, I think games are a sort of art form. So like painting captures the visual world, or music captures the heard world, I think games capture human agency, sort of forms of deciding and deliberating and acting and seeing those actions sort of manifest, in this case, manifest on our kitchen tables or wherever we're playing. So I think games are this really unique art form that capture agency, and we really like as human beings to practice and to hone agency.
Well, you have written a fascinating book. We didn't get to backgammon, but your first few pages of backgammon took me to Raiders of the Lost Ark.
I'm happy to hear that.
In my head, and so we'll leave that as a little tickle for people to take a look at your book. It's wonderful. Thank you so much, Ollie. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Oliver Rader, his book, Seven Games, A Human History. Take a look at it. You'll like it. Well, Garden Talk tomorrow. Lisa Johnson will be joining us. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.